Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by Forever Family Foundation. On the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name. The echo is haunting. The echo is always the same. I call your name. The echo is haunting. An echo can never be changed. So I call your name.
Hello and welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Comlock Center, and they can be found on the web at comlock.com, that's spelled K-A-M-L-A-K.com. Our guest tonight is Mitch Horowitz, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-627-6008. So, Bob, what would you like to chat about this evening?
Well, not a lot, because I'm anxious to talk to our guest, but I did, you know, there's a story in the news. It's a sad story. I'm not a soccer fan. That's one sport that I just never got into, but there's a famous soccer player, Emiliano Sala, that unfortunately his plane went down in the ocean.
Oh, I read about that.
Yeah,
he's
missing, and it's a very sad story. He was on his way to a new team where he just signed a $20 million contract on the plane. A search took place, and they announced today that they were giving up on the search because the chances of survival were, as they put it, extremely remote. And the story goes on to say the next of kin were informed of this development, and the person saying this that was conducting the research says his thoughts go out to the families of the pilot and the passenger at this most difficult of times. Now, the soccer player's sister, Sala's sister, Romina Sala, she pleaded for the search to resume, telling reporters that she believes the individuals on board are still alive, which... You know, you wonder, okay, does she, you know, really believe this? Or, you know, obviously you don't want people to give up the search. But then she says, I'm very confused. All I want is that they find my brother, that they find the pilot, that they put themselves in our shoes. She said, I feel it in me that they are alive, that they are well, that they are waiting for us. I ask you, please, to not stop looking for them. Please don't stop. I know they're alive. So, you know, when you read something like that, you know, I wonder, I know it's a natural reaction, you know, to not entertain the possibility that they're not. On the other hand, her conviction was so strong that she knows, her exact words, she knows that, you know, that's still alive. So that's interesting, you know, perhaps, you know, how does she know? I mean, does she know intuitively?
Well, you're assuming that by alive, she means... They're still in their physical.
They're still in their physical, yeah.
But let's not forget that there is always these thousands and thousands of stories of this sense of presence where even immediately after someone has crossed over, the surviving people feel them still around. So she could be also reacting. I'm not saying one way or another, but there's several possibilities here in it, and it seems like, yes, it's natural for a human being to want that search to continue until there's absolutely, absolutely no chance that they're going to find any survivors. But from the perspective of survival of consciousness, she could be sensing their presence in a non-physical form, or she could be sensing their presence in a physical form. We don't know.
Yeah, I mean, or she may be getting information and she doesn't quite know how to assimilate or identify its source, but she could be, you know, he could be reaching out to her, you know, telepathically, you know, to, you know, and saying something to the effect that I'm alive, you know, get the message out, you know.
Okay, but now you make me think of the book that was written right after the Titanic went down, Blue Island. And in Blue Island, W.T. Speed, who was on the ship, who was a paranormal investigator, channeled information after he went down with the ship to his surviving daughter, who did not get on the ship, giving her information blow by blow of what was going on as the people were crossing over and being received on the other side. And that's a very interesting, very, very short book. It was out of print. I think I've talked about it so much that somebody photocopied the pages and actually is selling it on Amazon right now. But it's very interesting that's exactly the situation he was in, except he did cross over and telepathically then sent the information to the surviving daughter.
Yeah. I just was trying to put myself in her shoes. And, you know, if I knew that I was getting, you know, a message, if that's truly what it is, I mean, how heartbreaking that is when you get a message and you're trying to act upon it and it's you're not making it happen, you know.
Right. So. But this is something that's common in the culture in which we live in now. I mean, you see cases where people, not even using a medium, get a visual of how an accident that led to the death of somebody actually occurred, and yet they can't go to the police and say, no, you should be arresting this person because there's no evidence.
I know. Well, perhaps someday we'll be able to refine these.
I think I believe maybe it's in Brazil where testimony from mediums is accepted as hard testimony.
I know that's true in one of the – I think it is in
Brazil.
Yeah. The somewhat related, I just wanted to mention, for those of you who read Signs of Life magazine, we like to put in what we call dazzle shots, which I would define as unique after-death communication or synchronicity that defies mainstream thinking.
Right, not a medium reading.
No, just some personal experience.
An actual experience, like something appearing where it would not normally be, the TV turning itself on, and then a special message being broadcast.
A significant, you know, after-death communication. And if you've had one of those and would like to share it, write it up and send it in an email to radio at Forever Family Foundation. Well, you know, consider it to put it in the magazine. Just when you do send that in, specify if you want us to list your first name or your full name, or you prefer to be anonymous, and we'll go from there. And with that, I think we'll go to our break because we have a wonderful guest coming up, Mitch Horowitz, who wrote The Miracle Club. And stay with us. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
The Camlack Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the Camlack Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlack.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
We all grieve in different ways, and let's face it, grief hurts. Losing a loved one is usually the hardest event we will ever face. We can throw our hands up and become hardened by our grief, or we can take positive steps to transform it. Love Knows No Death, a groundbreaking and powerful grief transformation method, can be what you've been looking for to provide some peace and understanding. It was created and written by medical doctor and professor Dr. Piero Calvi Perazzetti. and it's a combination of a self-help workbook and video course. The workbook has the power to lessen grief and foster significant healing, and has already helped countless people to not only lead productive lives, but to do so with the knowledge that they will indeed see their loved ones again. The workbook can be purchased for $19.95 on Amazon or on the ForeverFamilyFoundation.org grief and loss page, where a digital version is also available for $9.95. Love knows no death. Truer words have never been spoken.
Imagine seeing spirits are spontaneously speaking indigenous Brazilian rainforest languages. Janet Mayer, a psychic medium, does just that. In her new book, Spirits, They Are Present, she opens the door to her private life in order to share her compelling, fearful, and at times humorous journey, providing evidence that when we die, we simply make a transition to another life. Spirits, They Are Present, available now at www.janetmayer.net, Amazon, and other online booksellers. Order your copy today.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation.
For those just tuning in, our guest this evening is Mitch Horowitz. Our sponsor tonight is the Comlock Center, and they can be found on the web at comlock.com. That's K-A-M-L-A-K.com. Bob?
And Mitch Horowitz is an historian of alternative spirituality. He's a seeker of truth. He's widely known as a voice of esoteric ideas. He's a writer in residence at the New York Public Library, a lecturer in residence at the University of Philosophical Research in Los Angeles, and the Penn Award-winning authors of books, including Occult America, One Simple Idea, Mind as a Builder, and the book we're going to focus on tonight, The Miracle Club, How Thoughts Become Reality. Mitch has written for many different prestigious publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Time.com, Politico. He also narrates popular audiobooks, and Alternative Spirituality on CBS Sunday Morning, Dateline NBC, NPR's All Things Considered, and throughout the national media. And his website is MitchHorowitz.com. And welcome to the show, Mitch.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
And I'm glad to speak with you. I know I'm a fan of your writing, as I'm sure many of our listeners are.
And
when I saw the new book, Miracle Club, first I focused on the subtitle, How Thoughts Become Reality, because that's something that I definitely, believe in. And I trust your writing implicitly. And I was saying to myself, oh, God, I hope this is not one of these simplistic self-help books, where you're setting people up for disappointment and saying if you do this, then you're going to have reward and riches and your dreams will come true. And I started reading it and I realized this was not one of those books. So, but you know where I'm coming from. I mean, it is a problem, I think, that in a lot of these things that people feel cheated and disappointed and they're written in such a simplistic style that I think it turns people off. I mean, that's something that you were obviously aware of when you came up with the idea of writing the book.
Yeah, in a sense, the book is really a response to decades of popular literature, sometimes very appealing and successful literature in the whole New Thought, positive thinking, law of attraction area. But that same successful literature doesn't really allow for a lot of mature thinking or wrestling with tough issues in the mind power tradition, such as the endurance of suffering, even when you seem to be doing everything right, or the inconsistency, perhaps, of a program of mind power that seems to produce remarkable results, but then perhaps the well runs dry at one point or another. And I'm dissatisfied with the tone of sloganeering and catechism that permeates much of New Thought's popular literature, where the suggestion is always that one more affirmation or one more heartfelt visualization will solve a potential problem. The problems can go deeper than that, but it doesn't mean that mind power as a thesis, the principle that thoughts are causative, is false or is misleading. I think it's very true. It's very filled with profundity. It's a real path, but it needs leavening. It needs leavening by the light of maturity. And I don't think that the positive thinking movement has done a good job of growing up over the past 50 or 75 years, although I believe its ideas are sound, and that's why they're so deeply important to me.
Yeah, and you know, what intrigues me is, of course, we know there's extensive evidence from psi research that suggests that non-physical phenomena are enhanced by strong emotion. And this appears to fit in with your advice, because you suggest that putting thoughts out into the universe to let them percolate may not be enough. The thoughts must be accompanied by strong emotional conviction, visualization, mm-hmm. and a willingness to work at it. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's become more vivid to me at this point in my search, first of all, is that I think for various reasons, some of which you were citing, that our thoughts do have causative properties, but there can be a real interval of time and sometimes stretches of even years between a thought and its ultimate fruition. And when it does come to fruition, if you look back and if you maintain perspective and don't allow things to get lost, you know, in the march of time with all the events that distract us, you can detect uncanny correspondences between things that have occurred in your life and between thoughts that you may have held and cherished and that were very important to you at one point in your life. And I do think, and I go into this in the final chapter of the book, I think part of what's going on is that we don't live within the linear time structure and framework that we feel and experience all around us as a day-to-day reality. It's a brilliant and very important illusion that helps us get through the day. But in fact, based on studies in quantum mechanics, string theory, psychical research, a whole range of the hard sciences, as well as the social sciences and branches of psychology, I think demonstrate to us that there is this nonlinear interaction, it seems, between thought and event. And I think there's a degree of selection going on in terms of what we experience. And that selection seems to rest not only upon mental perspective, but a really emotionally charged sense of belief, which is why the combination of those two factors is very important in this thought system.
Mm. Is it possible to want something too much? I mean, to send out thoughts that are so strong and so focused that it inhibits the process?
That's a really good question. You know, and there are two points of tension on that topic that interest me a great deal. Within the world of chaos magic, and to some extent within the world of ceremonial magic, where people feel they can perform a rite and ritual that, in effect, outpictures their will into the world, you will sometimes hear people comment that it's very important that once you do your ritual, you do it in a way that's complete, that's satisfying, and that sort of flushes the desire out of your system, because you don't want to remain suspended in a state of hope. A state of hope is not a state of fulfillment. It's sort of hunger that's waiting to be sated. And so that's one perspective, which I honor. Another perspective, and the one that's probably more operative in my own life, is that actually I think holding a thought with an almost obsessive, passionate intensity is a tremendous means of concentrating your energies, physical and non-physical, psychological, and those that go beyond the cognitive and motor function toward a goal. And so I respect what my colleagues in the chaos magic world are doing, and I think they've discovered a lot of truth. But all of these roads sort of run parallel and converge on a certain point, which is being expressive in the world. And for me personally, the approach of really holding a thought, focused, emotively charged thought, and holding it to a degree that really borders on obsession, which to me is not a bad word, can serve as a tremendous engine of achievement, both physically and extra-physically. So I don't think wanting something too much, frankly, is a problem. Some might dispute that. But for me, I think that that's part of the engine of human expressiveness.
Yeah, I think you wrote, giving some advice, saying that always think from the end of the goal fulfilled.
So, yes.
So I guess what you mean by that is, you know, creating an environment, you're immersing yourself in the end result, and the rest will catch up.
That's precisely right. And it can be very hard to do. And frankly, I've found it of late difficult in some cases to cultivate the emotional state necessary for what you were just describing, that living from the end, that cultivating internally a feeling of fulfillment. And I've begun to wonder, frankly, if there are other ways to do it as well. Last night I was experimenting with this idea of the individual as a thespian, of the individual really on stage. And what if you were to act as though, just act as though something that you wished for was present in your life, and don't trouble yourself so much with whether the emotions are following in the wake of your behavior or whatever bodily posture or sort of internal compass you fix upon, but act as though, and don't worry so much about the emotions. It may be very possible that both emotion and event will catch up. So that's something I've been experimenting with as well, especially at times when I find it difficult to just summon the sublime emotional state that is associated with that kind of a task.
Yeah, and you refer to yourself as a believing historian, you know, because you participate in many of the movements you write about, and here you're participating in your own experiment. So I think that, I mean, do you think that we could learn more from the parapsychology research world if researchers were also practitioners in the areas they study?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, it presents sort of two different models in a certain way, because on one hand, we don't have a definitive answer as to whether ESP, for example, is general to the population in some greater or lesser degree, or is really the domain of a few uniquely gifted individuals. And there are parapsychologists who agree on many things, but they disagree on that question. So whether or not the parapsychologist can be a practitioner is an open question. I do know that some parapsychologists, including Dean Radin, who's been on your show and who's featured fairly prominently in the book, I think through his own experiments, which are really exquisite and very carefully conducted, Dean has become persuaded of the fact, as I have, that there is an extra-physical quality to the mind. And that, I think, has given Dean a sense personally to experiment with this idea of thought causation. And I retell a story in the book that Dean gave me his permission to use that's really extraordinary, where he needed a researcher to help him complete a certain project. And he was walking around thinking about applying for a grant or doing something that would allow him to procure the help of a qualified academic researcher in neuroscience. And an assistant of his said, you're going about this the wrong way. Don't think in terms of the grant or how you can procure the money. Think in terms of the end goal. What is it precisely that you want? And Dean said, okay, well, precisely what I want is A, B, and C. And he outlined a roster of some fairly rarefied traits. The next day, or in the ensuing days, a neuroscientist from the University of Toulouse in France came to visit Dean's laboratory and wished to volunteer his services and filled the entire roster of requirements that Dean had. And he said he has had remarkable experiences, remarkable synchronicities, when he gets very, very clearly focused and zoomed in on precisely what it is he wants. So there's an example of a parapsychologist who doesn't necessarily bring that belief pattern into his laboratory experiments, but he has been affected personally by what he has researched clinically.
Yeah, and perhaps it's given him, you know, insights into his formal research, things that he gleaned from the intuitive world. You know?
Yes, yes, may well be.
So people often report various phenomena during the dream state, the hypnagogic state, like precognitive experiences or
yes,
visits from discarnate entities. So what about, you know, when we're in this state, do you think our thoughts have a better chance of manifesting into reality when we're so-called in the unconscious state?
I do. The state of hypnagogia that you were referring to are those really exquisitely relaxed few moments that everybody experiences just before drifting off to sleep at night. And you experience a similar state just as you're coming to in the morning. And psychical researchers have found that those states of deep relaxation in which you're relaxed almost to the point of sleep, but you're still cognitively active, you haven't yet crossed over, those states of mind seem to be prime time for psychical activity, for ESP, and that has also been written about by some mind power practitioners who I dearly love, including the great Neville Goddard, who's a real hero of mine, the French mind theorist Emile Coué. He had an early instinct in the late 19th, early 20th century, which has been confirmed by contemporary sleep research, that those few moments before you drift off are a period of remarkable suggestiveness, a period in which your subconscious is really supple and ripe for reprogramming, if you so wish. And Neville felt that that was a unique time for mental creativity in terms of bringing about circumstance that you wished for. And sleep researchers have found that it's a really, really remarkable time in which reality seems to bend, and yet we remain capable of directing our own attention. And lastly, psychical researchers have found heightened states of apparent telepathy or ESP when people are induced into a comfortable state of hypnagogia. What all this tells us is a yes, a resounding yes to your question, that I think it's absolutely a given that this state of mind that you're in just before you drift off to sleep is a unique time of day which everybody experiences and which can be effortlessly used to recite a prayer or a suggestion, affirmation, visualization, whether from a psychological or metaphysical perspective. And I really encourage people to do that in terms of practical exercises, and it was certainly my commitment in this book to provide them. Everybody enters this natural meditative state twice a day, just before you drift off at night and just as you're coming to in the morning. Use it. It's very simple. It's the time of day in which all the exercises that we've mentioned, affirmation, visualization, and so on, they can be used to their greatest effect, I believe.
That's good advice and something that you do go into detail in the book. Let me read something to our listeners that you wrote in the Miracle Club, because I think it's significant. You write, I argue that we can pierce a thin veil that separates mental and spiritual experience, thus using our minds not only as tools of cognition and motor function, but as instruments of navigation into higher unseen realms of psychology and cause and effect. We may be unable to see, describe, or fully identify these other spheres of existence, but their impact is palpably felt in our lives. That's good stuff, Mitch.
Thank you.
And I guess the shame of it all is that so many of us are not open to even the possibility that there are other realms to which we're connected, so they're incapable of recognizing what's put before us. You agree?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, sure. You know, it's one of the problems of human nature. For some strange reason, we seem to prefer familiarity. It must make us feel safer. So when people arrive at a decision and are closed off to the possibility that their decision hasn't covered all the bases, if somebody interrupts that pattern of thought, they get, we as human beings, I along with everyone else, get very irritable, and we seem to, familiarity probably for very deep and primal reasons, feels very safe to people. But this approach can be poison in the intellectual world because it really makes it next to impossible to have a serious discussion either about mind causality or different dimensions of the placebo response or psychical research, as you and I were just discussing before. I was talking this over with a friend earlier today, actually, Ronnie Thomas, with whom I'm collaborating on a new documentary. And I was saying to him that we as an intellectual community here in the West and in other parts of the world, we have laboratory evidence of some kind of ESP or some kind of anomalous transfer of information in a clinical lab setting. Here in America, we've had that evidence since J.B. Rhind started his famous experiments at Duke University in the late 1920s, early 1930s. And I don't need to tell you and most of your listeners how heavily juried and carefully assembled and subject to criticism and transparency much of this academic research has been. And yet you'll still hear journalists and other people, some of whom are friends of mine, say in a matter-of-fact way that there's no laboratory evidence for the non-locality of the mind, or there's no laboratory evidence for any kind of mental functioning that goes beyond the traditional motor and cognitive. And they're just wrong. They're just wrong. And getting them to look at the right data and appreciate it is as impossible as getting a grand inquisitor to look through Galileo's telescope.
Right.
And this is a brokenness of human nature that we all suffer from. And it's understandable. It's understandable why people want to reinforce the familiar, but it really stymies the search, the individual search and the intellectual search.
And as you said, we live in two worlds. To deny one for the other brings us no closer to the truth.
Amen. Amen.
Right. We are talking with Mitch Horowitz, and the book is called The Miracle Club, How Thoughts Become Reality. We have a lot more to talk about with Mitch. We're going to go to a quick break, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes, so stay with us.
The CAMLAC Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the CAMLAC Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death, and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlac.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one. Starseed Gems Studios in Cocoa, Florida fuses cremation ashes within art glass, making beautiful stones. The ashes are visible in the darkness and resemble a beautiful night sky. Starseed Gems, developed by the parents of a young man who passed away, are set in hand-sculpted silver and gold settings. Prices start at $150. Visit www.starseedgems.com or call 321-632-7770. That's www.starseedgems.com or 321-632-7770.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
We all grieve in different ways, and let's face it, grief hurts. Losing a loved one is usually the hardest event we will ever face. We can throw our hands up and become hardened by our grief, or we can take positive steps to transform it. Love Knows No Death, a groundbreaking and powerful grief transformation method, can be what you've been looking for to provide some peace and understanding. It was created and written by medical doctor and professor Dr. Piero Calvi Perissetti, and it's a combination of a self-help workbook and video course. The workbook has the power to lessen grief and foster significant healing, and has already helped countless people to not only lead productive lives, but to do so with the knowledge that they will indeed see their loved ones again. The workbook can be purchased for $19.95 on Amazon or on the foreverfamilyfoundation.org grief and loss page, where a digital version is also available for $9.95. Love knows no death. Truer words have never been spoken.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation.
If you are just tuning in, we have been talking to Mitch Horowitz. Our sponsor is the Comlock Center, and they can be found on the web at comlock.com. We want to remind our listeners to check the events page on our website at foreverfamilyfoundation.org for up-to-date happenings. First, we have coming up for free next month on February 9th from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, 11 to noon Pacific, our Visionary Explorers group meets online. And our first webinar of the year will be presented by Dr. Michael Grosso on February 6th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, streaming live on your computer wherever you are in the world. Dr. Grosso recognizes the importance of understanding the mystical and the paranormal as they serve to expand our concept of the mind and accept the fact that we survive physical death. The webinar will focus on a singular case of St. Joseph of Cupertino, the man who could fly. Attendance is $6 for members, $20 for non-members, and here are some promo codes for our listeners for limited discounted seats. Members can register for any remaining seats for free with the promo code Cupertino. Non-members can register for any remaining half-price seats with the code GROSSO2019. Our annual Holiday of the Earth raffle is up and running. Enter now to win up to 5 medium readings with certified mediums Tracy Lee Nash, Neil Zapowski, Renata Santarelli, Catherine Nadal, and Eliza Ray. The drawing is set for April 22nd. That's Earth Day, and it's only $5 to enter. You might want to also save the date of July 26th to 28th. That's our annual summer grief retreat in Chester, Connecticut. Make sure you are on our member-only list to get first dibs at our below-cost reservations. And please, please, please help us keep all of our programs going by visiting our website and clicking on the donation button. It's on every single page. Because of the work we do not receive the grants and funding that all other traditional not-for-profits enjoy. You can also help us pay our bills by participating in iGive.com, Amazon.com, Amazon Smile, and great nonprofits. Just make sure that you select Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. And follow us on our YouTube channel for great stories and videos at youtube.com/afterlifeeducation. Back to you, Bob.
And we're back with Mitch Horowitz. His latest book is called The Miracle Club, How Thoughts Become Reality. I don't know how we missed talking to you, Mitch, about your prior book, you know, Occult America. It was right in our wheelhouse, but maybe you'll come back to talk about that in another
time. Oh, I can hear you now. Sorry about that.
Oh, you couldn't hear me? Okay.
Yeah, well, I lost you there. Sorry.
One thing I wanted to ask, many people in the metaphysical community, they will say readily that in order to take steps towards enlightenment, one has to set their ego aside. And so this seems to suggest that material prosperity and wealth doesn't fit in with such a plan. And your thoughts are a little bit different on that. Can you care to comment?
Sure. You know, and I appreciate the question. You know, there are, of course, a variety of different ways, some of them very deep and very compelling, from different spiritual paths on how to confront the material question, the question of where money and attainment and life's goodies, we'll say, you know, fits into the spiritual search. You know, you'll find compelling answers in Hinduism. You'll find compelling answers in Catholicism. There's all kinds of different perspectives, and each one of them is sturdy in its own way. But my perspective at this point in my search, at this point in my life, is, as I put it, mine really is a path of attainment. I do believe in generativity, productivity, striving as an expression of that which is actually most sacred and most holy in us. If we take seriously the idea which is so prevalent in the West, that God created man in his own image, so to speak, then it stands to reason that we as individuals are here to be creators of our own. And we do live within this material, psychological world. And I think that it's incumbent upon us to be happy in this world, to strive, to build, to grow, to generate, to produce. For some people that means art, for some people that means commerce, for some people that means something else entirely, or some admixture of all these things. But I am not, at this point in my search, pursuing a path that aims towards non-identification or non-attachment. And I don't actually make distinctions anymore between the inner and the outer, or the higher and lower, or concepts of ego versus essence. I still catch myself using the term ego because it is a useful term, but I don't really see these divisions as being legitimate to my search at this point in my life. I feel that we are ourselves engaged in an act of highest human expression when we are creating, when we are attaining, and that's the nature of my path.
I know that meditation is very important to you, and you write about it in the book, and your personal choice is transcendental meditation, which I remember from my college days, you know, back in the late 60s and early 70s. But some of our listeners may not be familiar with that particular type of meditation. Can you talk a bit about it?
Sure. Transcendental meditation is a form of meditation in which it was brought to the West by the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and it's a very simple, very powerful method in which you are given a mantra, a meaningless sound, basically, and you internally repeat this sound, and you enter into just exquisite relaxation. You enter into this very deeply powerful, relaxed state, and it's a good form of meditation for people who perhaps have found meditation doesn't come easily to them, because there is something that just immediately gets turned on in your brain when you use this mantra. And there's all kinds of neuroscience behind it, but the individual, him or herself, will experience a very, very deep and restful state of relaxation. So that's the TM method, and many people from different walks of life use it and find it deeply valuable.
Let me switch gears just for a moment. When I lost you a couple, just when we came back from break, I was mentioning your previous book, you know, Occult America.
Yes.
I was mentioning how, I don't know how we missed talking to you about that at the time, but hopefully come back some other time.
I'd be delighted. Yeah, I'd be really delighted. I've enjoyed our discussion.
But there's one thing that I wanted to ask you. I know you've written extensively about Ouija boards.
Yes, as
its history and so forth. And the reason I bring it up is we recently got into a discussion with some of the mediums that were certified by our foundation. And when the subject of the Ouija board came up, they they gave like the sign of the cross on.
Yeah, that's the third rail of metaphysics. We're all afraid to go there. The Ouija board is the third rail of metaphysics, you know.
Right. That their argument is that it represents an invitation from malevolent forces. So let's get your opinion on that, on a Ouija board.
I appreciate that question. I always like whenever people ask me about the Ouija board, and my own thinking on the matter has evolved, actually. My chapter on Ouija boards in Occult America is entitled Don't Try This at Home. So obviously I am at least nodding in the direction of the point of view of the mediums that you were talking to and how disturbed they were by the Ouija board. But that said, my thinking has changed. And I don't want to dissuade anybody from experimenting in any way they want to. I can point to a lot of things that have actually been very productive and good that have come out of the Ouija board. The third largest religion in the nation of Vietnam, which is called Cao Daism, it's the nation's third largest faith following Catholicism and Buddhism. That is an early 20th century religion that was essentially channeled through a Ouija board. And the Cao Dai faith has proven a very dynamic faith. For a while they were driven underground by the communist government, and now they've come above ground. They were actually stalwart allies of both the French and the Americans in Vietnam, and they had a private militia. They sided with U.S. forces in Vietnam as late as 1975. And then after that, the northern Vietnamese government drove them underground. But I cite this as just one example of many in which if people had been told, keep your hands off the Ouija board, what has become a hugely important and fortifying faith to a lot of people in the nation of Vietnam might never have come into being. And there are certain metaphysical thinkers who experimented with Ouija boards before dispensing with the board as a contraption and just going off on their own way, like Jane Roberts, the poet who channeled the Seth teachings. At one time, Esther and Jerry Hicks, the channelers, were experimenting with a Ouija board. It just represented a kind of threshold of sorts, an entry point, maybe even a novelty. But it was a way for some of these people to begin experimenting with their ideas. So I don't want to hear that anyone has been dissuaded from personal experiments if these things are consensual. And obviously, grown-ups have to take some responsibility for using things from credit cards to alcohol that, you know, can have its edges to it. So be responsible, but I'm not going to curb anybody's experiment. That's not part of my outlook at this point in life.
Yeah, my personal opinion, I always thought of it as it has more to do with the experimenter, the person that's using it, who may be acting as an attractor of good or bad, the same way that as if they were using any focusing device, you know. So
yes, I agree.
What about? I'll ask you another question that you've probably been asked a bunch of times, but I'm curious because you're such an intellect on the subject. But what do you think about the principle of karma? I mean, do our thoughts and actions come back to us?
It's such a huge idea. I am very touched by the fact that virtually every religious and ethical system on Earth, from earliest time, has cited the existence of some kind of cosmic reciprocity. Call it karma, call it the golden rule, call it the afterlife, call it whatever you want, but there is a persistent and deeply held belief across every stretch of human culture, going back to the most primeval periods of time, that what we do is reciprocal by the nature of the world that we live in. And I couldn't possibly walk away from that statement. I don't think that karma as a concept should be used casually. One of the things I write about in the Miracle Club that I want us to get away from in the New Thought world is people will sometimes toss around the word karma as an explanation for profound misfortune that befalls an individual. And I think that that's using the term in too much of a refrigerator magnet kind of way. We've gotten accustomed to using words like karma with shorthand, just like the word ego, and we use it unthinkingly. But I think it's an enormous concept. It's even if I were to say to you, I place validity in the concept, which I certainly do, I still have to fall to my knees in front of it because, you know, what's the mechanism by which this reciprocity befalls us? Is there a reincarnation, a recurrence of some kind involved? What's the time interval? You know, is it instant karma, as John Lennon said, sort of tongue in cheek, or do these things play out over vast stretches of time? We all feel intrinsically that there is something to the concept of karma, and I think we are correct. But it opens up so many more questions than it answers, you know, how these things occur, the period of time over which they occur, the method of conveyance, you know, it's very mysterious. But I don't think instinctively that the human race has been wrong for thousands of years in feeling that life is a cycle. Life is a cycle. It seems very natural to us. Nature is cyclical. Why shouldn't life and its ethics be cyclical in that what we do does get revisited on us?
Yeah, I think you're right. I also think that a lot of us, we find a certain degree of comfort in the principle of karma, even though we think
yes.
of it in a winning fashion. You know, if we do good things, they're going to come back to us, but the son of a bitch that does all the bad stuff is going to get his or her, you know, rewards, you know, afterlife.
Yeah.
I know we don't have a lot of time, but, you know, in discussing making miracles, I mean, everybody's fascinated by the subject of miracles. I mean, you talk about the power of one deeply felt wish.
Yes.
Elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, I was alluding to this a little bit earlier in the show that I think nothing is more motivating and extraordinary in the human experience than holding one absolute definite desire, something that you feel so emotionally committed to, it does become a veritable obsession. And if you look at people who you regard as heroes, living or dead, or from any field of work or life, whether they're soldiers or activists or inventors, entrepreneurs, diplomats, peacemakers, whoever your heroes happen to be, you'll almost always find that the individuals lived for and were defined by one very definite thing. And it's a law of nature that concentration increases impact. And I think I see people dissipate their energies, including their metaphysical energies, by having a diffuse and vaguely defined set of goals or some goals that are maybe even contradictory to one another. It's profoundly important as a way of getting anywhere in life to have one definite, absolute aim. And it can be difficult because, of course, we are all forced to wear different hats in life. You're a parent, you're a spouse, you're a breadwinner, you're a spiritual seeker. There's all kinds of different hats that we have to wear in life. That's why it can be very difficult, unless one is very emotionally driven, to select one absolute goal. But you will find that if you really can work on that and be unsparingly honest with yourself, you will find that that one goal may cover a lot of different bases and may satisfy a litany of needs. But you won't know unless you go through this process. And don't fool yourself and tell yourself, well, gee, I already know what my goal is. Because sometimes we repeat things to ourselves habitually, and it can obfuscate what we really feel. Yeah. Sometimes we are embarrassed about what we really feel. Sometimes somebody who thinks of him or herself as spiritual discovers that what they really want is money, you know, or something else. And it can be very tough to be deeply, unsparingly honest with yourself. But it's an incredible experiment. I suggest you do it in private. I suggest you not tell anyone what you're doing. Give yourself this kind of sense of inhibition that not telling anyone and not looking for anyone's approval or approbation or guidance gives you the freedom to be completely unembarrassed about what you want. And what you tell yourself in private can be hugely important. So it's an experiment that I challenge everyone to.
And people can learn more about what you just said by reading The Miracle Club, How Thoughts Become Reality, Mitch Horowitz is the author. Mitch, it's been a pleasure speaking with you tonight, and we hope
Thank
to
see you
again soon.
I'd be delighted. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Good Mitch. Night. Evening.
Thank you.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our global peace prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind. Now let us, as one consciousness, give our energy of loving thought by praying like this: to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.